And it is astonishing that, you know, he stood down from the Labour Party. Frankly, he should have been kicked out weeks and weeks ago. This is not something we should be sitting idly by. There's something serious going on here, and you know, we've been pushing for this with emergency debates in Parliament. We need to see the Prime Minister act now, not just sit idly, because there are serious questions to answer here,
including misconduct in public office. Yes or no?
Yes, I think we should explore it all.
Okay, Stuart Andrew, thank you for that. Thank you for joining me. That's it for today. I'll be back at 1 o'clock tomorrow. But next up on Times Radio is Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Don't forget Andrew back tomorrow with the Times at 1. It's 2 now. You're listening to Jane Garvey and Fee Glover until 4.
Coming up on the programme today, as shocking revelations from the release of the Epstein files just keep on coming, we're going to ask what it's like to be a survivor when nobody seems to be able to accept responsibility. Does the nation's capital need an opposition mayor? We'll speak to the think tank who says yes, it probably does. We're going to check in with the damp dress rehearsal of the Artemis launch, and the brilliant Vassos Alexander will join us in his new daily sports slot. We're after a name, so suggestions on the back of a postcard, please.
Let's start with the news at 2. Here's Stuart Willey.
Jane, thank you. Good afternoon. The Prime Minister has joined the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats, calling for Lord Mandelson to be out of the House of Lords after the latest release of legal files about Jeffrey Epstein. But a spokesman for Sir Keir Starmer says he doesn't have the power to remove Mandelson. The former ambassador to Washington resigned from the Labour Party last night. He denies accepting thousands of pounds from Epstein in the early 2000s. His Conservative leader, Cammy Badenoch.
All of these allegations that have come out just show that he is someone who is not fit for public office. I think there is a lot that needs to be looked into, including investigating how he ever came to be appointed and all levers which can be pulled in order to remove him from public office should be looked into, including removal from the House of Lords.
Meanwhile, there are calls for the Crown Prosecution Service to consider whether there's a criminal case against Peter Mandelson. Documents suggest in 2009, the then business secretary shared highly sensitive market information on secret plans to sell off government assets. The tax lawyer and investigative journalist Dan Needle told Times Radio that may have benefited Epstein's clients.
There was an email from Nick Butler, a special advisor to Gordon Brown, to a bunch of senior people at Number 10 and Peter Mandelson as business secretary. He made the point that we shouldn't just be talking about tax increases or cutting services. We could look about selling state assets. Peter Mandelson sent this 2 hours later to Jeffrey Epstein.
Downing Street say they're urgently reviewing the correspondence. Lord Mandelson says he doesn't recognise the claims. A serial killer known as the Suffolk Strangler has pleaded guilty to a sixth murder. Steve Wright, who was convicted in 2008 of killing 5 women in Ipswich, now admits murdering 17-year-old Victoria Hall in 1999. He's also admitted kidnapping a 22-year-old woman the night before. The 67-year-old is serving a whole life term for the 5 murders. The Foreign Office has summoned the Russian ambassador and revoked the accreditation of one of Moscow's diplomats. It's said to be in response to what's described as an unprovoked and unjustified decision to expel a British diplomat last month over accusations of spying. The Rafah crossing between Gaza and Egypt has reopened in both directions. Foreign Secretary Yvette Cooper has welcomed the limited opening, but claims more needs to be done under the terms of Israel's ceasefire with Hamas. At the moment, only a few people can pass through, not aid trucks. Maya Alawada from Medical Aid for Palestinians says that's not good enough.
The needs on the ground are immense, and what is allowed into Gaza is a drop in the ocean. And, you know, we see patients every single day needing medications and medical supplies and advanced surgical procedures.
And house prices grew more than expected in the year to January. Nationwide says there was a 1% rise on average after a lull in the build-up to the budget. For a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
A very good afternoon. We are here until 4 o'clock. It's Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio. You are very welcome, and you're welcome too to chip in as and when it suits you. The WhatsApp number is 0333 003 2353. We do have a new feature. It's the mighty Vassos Alexander who's going to give us the benefit of his sporting wisdom. He's going to join us every day to talk about the best sports journalism from the Times. And today, controversial stuff, this Fee. They get the same prize money. So why don't female tennis stars play five sets instead of three?
Well, why don't they?
Well, actually, some of the ones questioned about it don't want to. And I have a sneaking suspicion that some of the big tournaments probably don't want, if I'm honest, women taking up space when they probably attract bigger crowds, being honest, to the men playing.
So they want shorter matches and therefore a quicker Maybe. Progression through the tournament.
It's difficult, isn't it? Because you remember that women's Wimbledon final last year that was just awful because one of the players just completely fell apart. I think she only won one game and it was all over in about 35 minutes. And that was, it just wasn't a great advert for women's tennis. I know there are some amazing women's tennis matches. That wasn't one of them. So we'll talk to Vassos a little bit later today. NASA's Artemis 2 mission is looming. The space agency has now begun the countdown to what it's calling a wet dress rehearsal. We'll hear from a fascinating guest, actually, documentary filmmaker Chris Riley, who's got to know the crew. Four brave souls due to travel 400,000 kilometres from planet Earth. We'll ask, how are victims and survivors of sexual abuse supposed to cope with the endless coverage of the Epstein files? We've got tech news today from Will Guyot. He's always worth hearing from. And we're featuring a safe haven for bots and why and how we can combat all the AI slop we're just drowning in right now. We'll talk about the Grammys, which got political. Susie Goldsborough talks books after 3:30. And personal finance guru Adam Shaw on what many people regard as the ultimate safe haven, gold, although we need to say that the price of gold has actually, I'm going to say, plummeted just in the last couple of days. Why has that happened? And why is gold still worth so much more than silver? Just got a quick fact here. Gold is about £3,500 an ounce right now. Would you like to hazard a guess at how much an ounce of silver would cost you?
23p.
No, you're just being silly. It's £59.
Well, that's closer to 23p.
Huge difference. Yeah, you're right. I'll give you that. Right, what are the most read stories on the Times website?
In at number three, the truth about what men and women really desire. Gosh, this is a beginning of February story. Researcher on human romantic relationships, Paul Eastwick, debunks the idea that men and women are doomed to want different things in romantic relationships. Countdown to Valentine's Day starts here. The second most read story, Epstein is asked, are you the devil himself? In released video. Now, this is quite extraordinary. The paedophile denied the question. It's in an interview with Steve Bannon, President Trump's former chief strategist, and he insisted, Epstein, that is, that he did have a good mirror. The most read piece on the website today, though, is all about cultural creativity. Grammys 2026 highlights the 10 biggest moments of the night. It was a big night for Brits and a very bad night for Donald Trump. The night saw shining awards from Brit School alumni and political messages from artists criticising ICE. A lot of those. We're going to be talking more about the Grammys in just a moment's time. You can read all of those articles on thetimes.com. You do need your digital subscription. If you don't have one, get one. You can go to thetimes.com/subscribe.
That's all coming up later in the programme. Lots to look forward to. Hope you'll stick with us. Let's talk first about London Mayor Sadiq Khan, who should face an opposition mayor, with the aim being to reinvigorate democracy in the capital. That's the view of a new report from a think tank, Restate. It also says the number of London boroughs should be cut by more than half. Let's check in with Simon Kay, who's the Director of Policy and Research at Restate. Hello, Simon. How are you?
Hello. Hello, Jane. I'm very well. How are you?
Yeah, good. Thank you. So let's talk about this. What would an opposition mayor in London do?
Well, it's an interesting question. So there's a lot of recommendations in our report. And quite a lot of them are to do with strengthening the mayor, the case for making sure the mayor is powerful enough to compete globally, so that London in turn is also powerful enough to compete globally. And if you're going to do that, you also need to bolster the scrutiny and the accountability of the person holding that office and all the machinery that sits below that person. Right now, I think the average Londoner would struggle to name their assembly member for the constituency representative on the assembly. I think right now, the assembly could probably be fairly characterised as quite an invisible chamber. So there's actually an English way of bolstering and creating a bit of a locus of scrutiny in our system, and that's using an official opposition role. That's true in England, of course, in the Westminster Hall. It's also true in Scotland and Wales. And that should probably draw attention in a way that might not encourage people to grab a bowl of popcorn and watch Mayoral Question Time, but it might build a little bit more awareness and that bottom-up scrutiny that the system really needs.
That would be, let's say if we did go for the leader of the second biggest party in the London Assembly, that would make the Tory Susan Hall then the leader of the opposition. Is that right?
Yes, it would be. Yes. So it'd be the leader of whatever grouping in the assembly is not involved in direct government as
well. Right. OK. So, I mean, is the London Assembly worth anything, or is it little more than a kind of talking shop?
Well, I think some people would call it a talking shop. They do important work, but the problem is that a lot of that work is sidelined or too easy to ignore by the public, too easy to ignore by the mayor, too easy to ignore by Westminster as well. One of the strange features of the last few years is there's been a little bit of a surge in devolution across England. They've called it a devolution revolution in central government. But it hasn't extended to London. There's this prevailing current of opinion within Westminster and Whitehall that London's sort of fully baked and done and off the table now and doesn't need to be come out again. But we really disagree. It's been 25 years since the GLA was set up, and a lot of the factors that go into its operation are sort of outmoded now and need to be revised.
If I were cynical, which of course I'm not, Simon, I might think that a right-of-centre think tank might be quite keen on just clipping the power of Sadiq Khan just slightly. What would you say to that?
Well, I'd start by saying that you're probably right about a right-of-centre think tank, Jane, but we're not a right-of-centre think tank. We're straight down the middle and fully politically independent. I think it doesn't really matter what your politics are. You probably want an increasingly powerful figure, and that's what we want, an increasingly powerful mayor to compete globally, to be held strongly to account within that system. That includes political accountability, it includes public accountability from the bottom up, and technical accountability, and all of that's featured in our report.
Where does London get its money from?
London's money, like the whole local system in this country, comes primarily from power from finances that are sent from central government outward. And that's one of the things that makes London one of the massive outliers. So if you look at other global cities, places like Paris, it's about 16% of their budget is stuff that's been transferred from central coffers. You look at Tokyo, it's more like 5 or 6%.
Yeah, so where are they getting the rest of their dosh from then?
They have the ability to set and raise their own financial, their own capability to under fiscal devolution to raise money.
Right. And so London could do that too?
We really think London ought to do that. We think the whole country should benefit from a bit more fiscal devolution, because that could be one of the things that really incentivizes the kind of policy that will bring about economic growth. We've all been pondering that productivity puzzle for quite a long time now, but we're also in one of the most over-centralised countries in the world. It could be there's a connection between those two facts of low growth and deep over-centralisation, because Whitehall doesn't always know what policy will be best arranged to create growth in different parts of the country. London should lead the way in that policy change. And it's quite encouraging that there's starting to be some interest in this coming from central government, starting with the tourism levy.
Right. Yeah, but so what, remind us, what is going to happen with the tourism levy? Where is that money going to go?
Well, this is all to be decided. The devil's in the detail, as ever, with these things, Jane. So there's a consultation going on right now. The question is whether mayoral authorities, strategic authorities like London or like Greater Manchester, will become the home for the revenues that are taken out of the tourism levy, or whether that's going to go to constituent authorities, local authorities, which are the traditional billing authorities in our country. I've got a pretty clear view in my head where I think that should go. It should sit at mayoral level to help enable those strategic economic decisions. But it's still an open question what's going to happen with that policy.
Just a quick message here from a listener who's called Andy. Andy says, if you ever see Sadiq Khan talking to Susan Hall, who's the Tory leader in the London Assembly, he answers no questions and has a contempt for her that, for me, verges on misogyny. It's pointless to have an opposition leader because I think he'd treat them with the same contempt unless they were male. Well, there you go. Simon, any thoughts on that?
Well, my main thought is that the average person has not seen Sadiq Khan interact with Susan Hall because the average person hasn't seen mayoral questions and hasn't tuned in. There's a massive democratic deficit.
Yeah, OK. I mean, I was also struck by the fact that there aren't that many members of the London Assembly, considering how huge the city is and how diverse and how extraordinary and how brilliant, in my opinion. Why only 25 members?
Well, that's a product of the original settlement for the way the Assembly was constructed. It's a combination of list-based members from across the whole capital and constituency members. There are these London Assembly constituencies. No one knows which constituency they're in. No. Most people couldn't name who their Assembly member representative is. We have a new idea in our report, which is that actually it's the borough leaders for London's boroughs who should be put into the Assembly in place of those constituency members to create a connection. Because at the moment, what we have is sort of a two-track system that most people can't puzzle out at all.
So just who would that be exactly? The leader of your local council?
Precisely. So the leader of the borough in which you live. So part and parcel of that plan for us is making sure we consolidate the number of boroughs. You'll be aware, Jane, there's a massive process of reorganisation sweeping through the rest of the country right now. The government has set an explicit target. Every local authority should be a unitary, just one tier, and should be about 500,000 people, about 500,000 people. London is weirdly exempt from that. None of the boroughs really match up to that standard. There's a couple of boroughs like Hammersmith and Fulham who barely make it to 200,000 residents. And a lot of Londoners probably look at that and think that's probably a bit wasteful. And that's a system that's been in place for 60 odd years. And most people don't feel much affiliation or connection with their borough. So it's time to take a fresh look at that. But yes, part and parcel of that, you can keep about the same size of London Assembly and bring in the leaders in place of the constituency representatives to create a connection between councils and GLA.
Right. And I guess that would be interesting because then you could properly, if you were concerned about refuse or potholes or something of that nature, you could properly, if you took an interest, you could hold the person actually responsible to account.
Yes, and that accountability would flow up through one track of the system rather than having two different things going on that aren't really compatible with each other, different Lego pieces that don't mesh with each other or puzzle pieces from either side of the board. By putting those things together, you create a single track and you also have new ways to escalate and you force the mayor and the team around the mayor to take the concerns of boroughs much more seriously.
Yeah, just very briefly, I mean, why do you think Sadiq Khan has been popular? I mean, he keeps winning. He keeps becoming London mayor. Now, it's a democratic vote. People vote for this man. Why do you think they do?
It's a very interesting question. It's not the case that London has been sort of monochrome politically in the past. As you know, we've had Boris Johnson, who's been a Conservative mayor, as well as Labour mayors and an independent mayor in the form of Ken Livingstone originally. So London does have the ability to change politically. I think, and I go out on a slight limb by saying this, Jane, actually, the people running against Sadiq Khan haven't been particularly inspiring in the past. And it'd be interesting to see if he'd have a bit more of a run for his money, or any candidate from any party might, if the quality of candidates improved. A more efficacious and powerful London system would encourage the best people to go for those jobs.
OK, thank you very much, Simon Kay, Director of Policy and Research at Restate, a think tank.
My suggestion, says Neil, for Vassos's segment, and now for something properly interesting and not another discussion on politics. Well, Neil, it trips off the tongue, that's for sure. And you'll be delighted that we're talking about something different next. Sabrina Carpenter had an airplane on stage. Lady Gaga had a lampshade with feathers on her head. And Bad Bunny told Donald Trump what he can do with his ice. It's all the fun and the flair of the Grammys. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. The kitchen and bathroom sale is now on. You can explore all of the sale offers at wix.co.uk, or why not just visit your local Wix store.
Time. Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
Make sure you don't miss us from 6 o'clock on Times Radio Breakfast. We'll bring you all the news and analysis. The fallout from the Epstein files continues.
And what's really happening inside Iran? We'll speak to a protester who's there in the country, willing to give us their own first-hand perspective.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel. Tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio.
Life is short. The world is big. See more of it with Wild Frontiers. Experience the soul of Georgia through traditional winemaking. Find your Zen on ancient pilgrimage routes in Japan. Or enjoy a 1,000-star experience in a yurt camp on the Silk Road. Wild Frontiers' expertly crafted journeys take you further, so you can wander often, wonder always, and worry never. For small group tours and tailor-made adventures, visit wildfrontierstravel.com.
My dad is more than just a dad. My dad provides life-changing support to those affected by disaster and conflict, helping people in crisis, whoever and wherever they are. Through the gift that he left in his will to the British Red Cross, my dad still makes a difference to the world, even though he's no longer with us. You can make a difference too. Please go online and search Red Cross Wills and consider leaving a gift in your will to the British Red Cross.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes. The experts in bathrooms. From a shiny new tap to a full bathroom renovation, Wickes has everything you need for every style of home. Browse thousands of bathroom products at wickes.co.uk.
Now, last night's Grammy Awards saw big wins for British stars, with Olivia Dean taking home Best New Artist and Lola Young winning Best Solo Pop Performance for her hit single Messy. But the biggest loser of the award show was undoubtedly President Donald Trump. The US president faced widespread condemnation from the gathered stars of the music industry, particularly from Puerto Rican artist Bad Bunny, real name Benito Antonio Martinez Ocasio, whose Ice Out speech got a standing ovation. Let's take a listen to some of the winners and those speeches.
I want to say I'm up here as a granddaughter of an immigrant. I wouldn't be here. I'm a product of bravery, and I think those people deserve to be celebrated.
Si te quieres divertir.
Eyes out. We're not savage, we're not animals, we're not aliens, we are humans and we are Americans.
No one is illegal on stolen land.
Well, you get the idea. Music there from Lola Young, Olivia Dean, Bad Bunny, and it's worth saying that after his speech, there was a standing ovation. It went on for hours. Some exaggeration there, but you get the point. And Billie Eilish as well, we heard, and we heard Olivia Bunny's and Eilish's speeches. Well, I've been talking with music journalist and albums critic Helen Brown. That's all the political stuff, but we did start with what's hugely, hugely important at the Grammys, which is the music.
Justin Bieber had a spectacular moment stripping everything back down to the rawness. I mean, he literally stripped back down to his socks and boxer shorts with the guitar slung around his neck. But I think it was a very moving triumph to have somebody come mature out of that kind of very formulaic child star mode and then express some real human vulnerability as a mature husband and father. It was really spine-tingling moment, actually.
Some of the other performances are definitely worth a mention, aren't they? Because if his was very pared back, Olivia Dean's wasn't, was it?
No, she was gorgeous. You know, I mean, she is a full-on performer. Everyone who's seen her live talks about, you know, this spectacular charisma that she has. But also then you had Lady Gaga performing, you know, sort of high-energy stuff, twiddling the kind of synthesizers and wearing a massive basket covered in feathers as a hat. You had Sabrina Carpenter pulling on her full sex pop camp act, singing Man Child. It was an evening of actually really great performances and a wide range.
Tell us about the significance of Bad Bunny.
So Bad Bunny is a Puerto Rican artist, and what he's so good at is these kind of unpredictable blends of reggaeton and trap. So he pulls in like traditional Puerto Rican sounds with a very modern sound. It's really exciting. And I was going to say that what so many of the artists that we celebrated at the Grammys have in common is the fact that they're kind of messy genre mashups are the kind of human expression that I don't think AI could deliver. Everyone's talking about how AI is going to destroy the creative arts. And what I was thinking watching the Grammys is actually AI couldn't come up with this. I mean, I'm sure now you could ask AI to create a Bad Bunny track or a Lola Young messy track, but AI can't originate this stuff. They were all such unique human beings.
I think it's such a good point to make, isn't it? And actually, if you want to see human creativity in full fat form, then those yes. performances at the Grammys last night are exactly what technology will never achieve.
You can't make it up, can you? And it was glorious. You know, I really enjoyed it. And also, you know, we have so many of the British winners. We had a great night for British artists. And so many of those artists are graduates of the free to attend Brit School, you know, at a time when the curriculum so long, you know, I've got teenage children and, you know, the curriculum has been pulling back or you won't, you know, we haven't got the funding for music anymore. We haven't got the funding for theatre trips anymore. Creativity's off. STEM. And I'm not saying STEM isn't hugely important, but actually it's looking now like the AI can do a lot of that. And what it can't do is, you know, tell a woman to put a basket on her head and sing magic songs while playing with, you know, 1970 synthesizers.
You're absolutely right, Helen. Who then is a Brit School graduate out of the winners or the award nominees from the Grammys?
As far as I'm aware, Ray, who won the Social Change Award, which is before the broadcast section. I love Ray. I'm a huge Ray fan. She's a Brit School graduate. Lola Young, who won Song of the Year for Messy, another Brit School graduate. And then Olivia Dean, who is the best newcomer with her absolutely gorgeous old school soul. That album for me was like a warm bath last year to get through all the divisions. Now, we talk a lot about these sort of gender divides and, you know, Sabrina Carpenter had a lot of fun on stage, sort of knocking men as man children and, you know, all the ways we have to organise them. But in this divided world, wasn't it lovely to hear a young woman like Olivia Dean get up and tell men, but actually, you know, you can be the people we need. Just have a chat, sit down, talk about what you're feeling, and you could be the men we need. It was a lovely olive branch in the gender wars, I thought.
So we must talk as well about all of the things that were said on stage in the acceptance of these awards, because Olivia Dean started, didn't she, by saying, I'm the proud granddaughter of an immigrant, and those people deserve to be celebrated. And she was by no means alone in wanting to highlight the anti-immigration policies of Trump.
Yes, I think, you know, it was fairly universal, wasn't it, across. I mean, you know, you have Bon Iver arriving with the anti-ICE pin. Bad Bunny made a very moving speech about the importance of immigration. And music has always and will always be an international language. You know, we go to music, we go to the visual arts to express the things that we cannot put into words and that transcend borders and any kind of racial and social divisions. The problem is that your MAGA voters always see Hollywood and the music industry as a remove from their real lives. I doubt any of this will make any kind of impact on a MAGA voter.
So it probably won't make an impact on a MAGA voter, but actually when you look at the streaming numbers and when you look at the old-fashioned, you know, what is still called record sales, there are millions and millions, if not billions of people buying into the talent of these artists. I mean, just Bad Bunny alone, I think, am I right in saying that he's been streamed, is it something crazy? Like 19, I don't want to say 19 billion, it's at least 19 million. I mean, these are massive, massively popular artists.
Yes, you know, and again, that's a global reach, isn't it? You know, this is the first Spanish language album to win the Best Album Award. So that's, you know, that's groundbreaking. We've had K-pop dominating a lot of charts. You know, we had Rosé performing at the Grammys. So, you know, music, that American sort of stranglehold, the Anglophone stranglehold on pop music is vanishing. And that's kind of, you know, giving hope, I think, to people around the world that, you know, with the accessibility of music, with the accessibility that technology gives anyone in their bedroom to make an album, you know, this suddenly is possible. It's all coming out of the hands of the tech billionaires.
There has been a little bit of response, hasn't there, from Donald Trump? But in fact, it was about Trevor Noah, who was the host, making a joke about him. What was the gag?
The gag was about how the Album of the Year award is something that everybody wants more than Donald Trump wants Greenland. And then he said that Donald Trump would need somewhere, he was looking for a new island to hang out with Bill Clinton now that Epstein Island was off limits to them. Trump obviously hit back, claiming that he was never there at the same time as Bill Clinton. He called, he's threatening to sue Trevor Noah. Trevor Noah just said, well, you know, it was my last awards anyway. And Trump, I think, has called the whole Grammys a garbage, a waste of time, a waste of money. So, you know, but he does this after every Oscars awards, after every Grammys, because these people are always going to speak out against his policies, and he's always just going to say they've got no right to an opinion.
Well, we are here to celebrate the fabulous music, and it was fabulous last night, and also we shouldn't let you go before mentioning the tribute to Ozzy Osbourne. So Birmingham's finest lived large at the Grammys last night.
Wasn't it glorious? And it's lovely to see Sharon Osbourne so happy. I think, you know, with the sadness, and also there was a great tribute to Roberta Flack, who was my childhood idol growing up. First Tape was, you know, her first album was one of my favourites of all time. But yeah, it was just great. I think, you know, Ozzy's passing has been sad, but also so many people have just celebrated his kind of extreme enthusiasm for life. And that absolutely came across in the performance.
That is albums critic, music journalist and friend of the show, Helen Brown. Jane, how many streams do you think Bad Bunny has had?
Oh, I'm going to get it wrong, but I'll have a go. 650 million.
19.8 billion.
What?
19.8 billion? Billion, yes.
How is that possible?
And recognised at the Grammys, and really a first for a Latin artist to be recognised quite so widely across the board. So hats off to him. And Bob does say the Grammys are a pretentious, what's it, full of egotistical maniacs whose political views are meaningless. And I think Bob, I'd just challenge you on that, because I think if you've got 19.8 billion streams, you're adored, absolutely adored by an extraordinarily large global fan base. I think those are words of meaning. Mm. And it's not just to the room, is it? I'm sure you would be able to chuck some stuff at the people in the room. But I think outside of the room, all of the things that have been said by those artists have gone down incredibly well.
The Bunny is booked to be the half-time entertainment.
Take the parent out of the playground.
You really can't. at the Super Bowl.
Yes.
Yeah, but I wonder if Bunny will cling on to that, bearing in mind the criticism. Who knows? The Super Bowl is one of those much discussed, but in my head, in my experience, not ever watched.
Sporting
experience.
You?
No, never seen it. Don't think about it. Right, it's always the Piccalilli strollers versus the something others. Anyway, next on Times Radio, we're going to discuss Artemis 2, and in particular, its wet dress rehearsal. It's just after 2:30. Here are the headlines. Stuart Willey.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Jane, thank you. Good afternoon. The Prime Minister thinks Peter Mandelson should lose his peerage and be removed from the House of Lords. Sir Keir Starmer's spokesman says he also believes the former US ambassador should testify in Congress over his links with the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Meanwhile, analysts have identified that the latest photographs of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor were taken inside Epstein's New York mansion. The former prince can be seen crouching over a fully clothed woman who's lying motionless on the floor. Kate Mansey is The Times assistant editor and hosts The Royals podcast.
It's hard to see now what more the king can do, apart from perhaps to persuade Andrew to testify to US Congress. Now, I'm speaking to people around the palace who say that's very difficult because as a private individual, the king cannot compel his brother to do anything, really. And it really will be down now to Andrew's conscience.
It's understood MP Dan Norris has been further arrested on suspicion of sexual offences, including rape. He's been suspended from Labour since April. People who advertise illegal routes into the UK on social media now face up to 5 years in prison. The Border Security Minister says the government is coming for smugglers. And the journalist and writer Janet Street Porter has announced her fifth marriage. The 79-year-old says she saved the best till last, marrying her long-term partner, the entrepreneur Peter Spanton. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
Life is short. The world is big. See more of it with Wild Frontiers. Experience the soul of Georgia through traditional winemaking. Find your Zen on ancient pilgrimage routes in Japan. Or enjoy a 1,000-star experience in a yurt camp on the Silk Road. Wild Frontiers' expertly crafted journeys take you further, so you can wander often, wonder always, and worry never. For small group tours and tailor-made adventures, visit wildfrontierstravel.com.
Get the day's politics, business, and sport every weekday in Breakfast from 6:30 a.m.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms. Wix local design experts are ready to help. Whether you start with an in-store design consultation or with a free home measure, it's completely up to you. Find out more about the free design service at wix.co.uk.
I know the Super Bowl's popular, just not with me.
No, I don't think condemn it out of its existence because
well, do.
You don't like it.
Yeah, I don't like it, and that's that.
Can I just say goodbye to Bob, who's left us? Bob also contributed to our musical discussion by saying each person listens to one track loads of times. Even so, I would say that you've got to listen to tracks from the moment that you get up in the morning until the moment you go to bed at night. You're right there, John. In order to garner 19.8 billion streams.
You'd be doing some. It does suggest that Mr. Bunny has some very dedicated fans.
It does. Bob, come back. Come back. Let's not have a row. It's only Monday. Hello, John.
Hello, Fee. So, the story of Peter Mandelson, Lord Mandelson, as he still is, just keeps on rolling and growing, doesn't it? Now, at 4:30, there's going to be a statement in the House from the Prime Minister's Chief Secretary, Darren Jones, which is going to be interesting. We're going to obviously take that live. And before and after, we're going to be looking at the way this story just keeps on developing. I mean, when Mandelson was stripped of his ambassadorship, that was a big enough story. He was in contact, it turned out, with Epstein, you know, after the guy had been convicted of a paedophile crime. Now, we have record in the Epstein files that Mandelson was in contact with Epstein and passing on highly sensitive, market-sensitive information, correspondence to the Prime Minister from a number 10 aide. And that raises wider, bigger questions on the depth of the story, the scandal, and the conduct of Peter Mandelson. So I'm going to be looking, among many other things, on how the government's handling it, and also the question of misconduct in public office, and maybe trying to get some legal opinion about that. And the story develops in different ways. Of course, there's Prince Andrew, there's the Epstein file scandal in America. We're looking at all of that. How might it roll in America? How's it going to roll here? And that's probably enough to be getting on with, because we're still in the process of putting it together. But it sounds like it's going to be quite a programme.
John takes over from us at 4 o'clock, runs through until 7, covering very important stuff today.
Yes, and thanks to Amanda for her little bit of support. She's never watched the Super Bowl, nor does she intend to, Fee.
Yeah, so okay, that, so that's two that's of us. Two women against, I think, global audience. Let's look up the exact figure.
NASA is getting ready for the launch of its first manned mission to the moon in 54 years. This is Artemis 2. The space agency has begun the countdown to what's described as a wet dress rehearsal. Now, yes, you're probably wondering, and Chris Riley is a man who can answer that question. He is a documentary maker, and he got to know the astronauts crewing the mission while working with Tom Hanks on a production called The Moonwalkers. Chris told me what a wet dress rehearsal entails.
Yes, it's a curious name, isn't it? But the wet actually refers to the fact that they're using liquid propellants. That's the stuff that powers the rockets when they have to kind of blast their way off this big gravity well that we're all sitting in here right now to climb up that hill and into towards the moon. So the thing that powers the main engines on this huge rocket, which is bigger than the Saturn V rockets that launched the Apollo missions back over 50 years ago, is mostly liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen. And those are called cryogenic propellants. They are stored at incredibly cold temperatures. So the liquid hydrogen's at -252 degrees centigrade. And so managing these very, very cold and explosive fluids is why it's called a wet rehearsal. And they pump these into the rocket. And honestly, this is the first time on the launch pad that these fuel tanks have been filled with such cold temperature liquids. And that means that the metals and alloys and other materials, they all start to contract. And the rocket really comes alive. And when I've talked to astronauts who've ridden these rockets before, they say that it does truly feel like this thing is a machine that's turned into a living thing when those propellants are on board. And the reason for sort of rehearsing all that is that things behave a bit differently. They can run the simulations that are for these real-world conditions for launch day itself, which is looming very soon. And they can test all the valves and pumps and the electrical systems with the actual liquid in place, hence wet dress rehearsal.
OK, now the actual launch, you said it's imminent. We don't have a date because it's weather-dependent, is it?
Yes, it's dependent on a lot of things. So not least this wet test, first of all. If that all goes well, then they'll stick to schedule. If there's any small changes in extremes, they might drain all the propellant out again and then roll the rocket all the way back into the hangar where it was built and do some things. That could delay them months, you know. So everything's sort of up in the air at the moment. But you're right to raise the weather because actually, you know, it's winter and some of these rocket systems don't work very well in very cold temperatures. We're just about the 40th anniversary of the Challenger disaster, which you might remember when the space shuttle blew up on launch. And that was because it was launched in temperatures that were too low and the seals on the solid rocket boosters were too fragile and brittle and they broke. And so they have to be acutely aware of all the weather as well.
We should say that the astronauts are not on board for this dress rehearsal.
That's correct, exactly. So this goes on for something like 36 hours, this kind of rehearsal, and they stop and start the clock and so on. And that will be too long to keep the crew sort of on board in these cramped conditions on the launch pad. So, no, they won't be on board. But the crew milestones, like closing the hatch, testing the launch abort systems, that kind of thing, they will all still happen. So they test everything except the actual human beings being on board, yeah.
And I think you've met the human beings. I mean, they are phenomenal, these people. Their courage is just off the scale. But they're just so accomplished as well. Tell us a bit about them.
Well, they are all overachievers, I would say. That's for sure.
That's one way of putting it.
You do feel like an imposter when you're with any astronaut, really. And I've been very lucky over the years to work with lots of astronauts, including all the moonwalkers. So, yeah, I know a bit about what makes them tick and this crew as well. I was very fortunate to co-write a show called The Moonwalkers with Tom Hanks, which is playing, it's an immersive show playing in London's Lightroom. And it involves all of the Artemis II crew that are going to the moon in the coming weeks. And when you meet them, and we hung out with them for a while at Houston, Tom and I, just chatting with them and getting to know them a bit and watching them training and asking them stuff about where they were going. And what strikes you actually about all of them is how comfortable and connected they are with each other. They are like an extraordinarily close, tight family. They've spent so long together for years, traveling together. Their families hang out together. I've been to barbecues with them in Houston and all their family come along. And it's a lovely kind of connected environment. And so that's really what you want when you're going to be working under pressure in a relatively small environment. They're on this spacecraft which is not much bigger than a large SUV, I'd say, and they're going to be there for at least sort of 8 days away from Earth together. So it's a good thing that they get on. But they're incredibly calm, kind, thoughtful people and really great company.
Yeah, there's one woman and three men this time round.
Yes, that's right. So the commander, Reed Wiseman, and Victor Glover, he's the pilot. And then the two mission specialists are Christina Cook and the Canadian astronaut Jeremy Hansen.
Right. The mission specialists, what are they there to do?
Yes. No, it's a good question. So, of course, you want a commander and a pilot for something that's flying, obviously, and there's lots of those systems to test. But, of course, the mission specialists are principally also there to do some of the other testing. So, for example, the purpose of Artemis 2, it's not going to land on the moon. It's going to fly around to the far side. It doesn't even really go into an orbit of the moon. It's on this thing called the sort of slingshot, which then the moon's gravity pulls it back and it travels past the other side of the moon and then falls very fast back to Earth. And so they want to test all of the engine systems that tweak and change that trajectory. They really want to test the life support systems. The whole thing has flown actually with mannequins on board. That was Artemis 1 a couple of years ago now, where they tested the life support without humans. But this is the ultimate test, obviously. They want to test navigation systems. They need radiation defenses on the spacecraft. And so the mission specialists on, in this case, Christina and Jeremy, they'll be kind of monitoring all of those systems. Obviously, they're going to carry cameras as well. There's lots of photography to be done as they make the first human close encounter with the moon in over half a century. So lots of chance to do an awful lot of extra supportive stuff, yes.
How do they get back to Earth?
Well, so the thing about this trajectory that they're being placed on is that it's not dissimilar to the Apollo 13 trajectory. Now, you'll probably remember that from Tom Hanks' film, Apollo 13. And this was when there was an explosion on a NASA spacecraft, just the third attempt to go and land on the moon, which put the entire mission in jeopardy, risked the lives of the crew. And the only thing that they could do was use physics to get them back because the engines were damaged. So they made tiny trajectory corrections and used the moon's gravity to put them on a kind of railroad that threw them around the moon and back to Earth, straight back to Earth again. And that, on purpose this time rather than by accident, is what Artemis 2 is going to do. So this journey is like being on a kind of railroad track out to the moon. They say Isaac Newton's in the driving seat because he's kind of, you know, the laws of physics are powering their return to Earth. And so whatever happens, they will come back.
They will come back. I mean, but there are no, let's just be honest, there are no guarantees. This is a dicey enterprise. I mean, I'm not for one minute wanting it to go wrong, but there is jeopardy here, isn't there? This is not something we should ever take for granted.
Oh, totally, for sure. The thing is, if you look in a textbook or even on the NASA press releases, actually, of this trajectory they take, they compress the distance on these drawings between the Earth and the Moon to fit it on a page of a website or something. But the true scale will blow your mind if you actually look at a scale drawing of the Earth and the Moon. They're going 1,000 times further away than the space station or the shuttle has taken humans for the last sort of few decades. And 1,000 times further away, 250,000 miles from Earth, there really is no way of suddenly sending up a rescue mission or fixing something that when you're that far away. You have to be totally self-sufficient. And, you know, actually, Jane, that's actually what makes these astronauts so incredible, as you kind of mentioned earlier on. They have trained to the nth degree. There are these departments at NASA called what-ifs. What if departments, where they what if the heck out of the mission, basically. They think about every possible thing that could go wrong, and they train to the nth degree to make sure they can cope with all of those things. So they're in safe hands, I'd say, even though they're 1,000 times further away than any human has been for half a century.
Yeah, and of course we've got to ask, why is it over half a century since anything like this has been attempted?
Yes, that's also a terrific question. To answer it, you've really got to examine why we went during the days of Apollo. And that was because, of course, you'll remember it was a race. It was a race against the Russians in those days. And a race has a finish line. And by the time America had proved to the world that it could land people on the moon 6 times, in fact, even taking an electric car and driving through the mountains of the moon, as the adventures of the later Apollo missions proved, the race was won, and that's when the racing stopped, really. And then they did different things. They built a shuttle, they put satellites up, they built a space station, And we remained in Earth orbit simply because there wasn't really the will to go any further. But of course, with 50 years of experience of living off Earth, and remember, with the space station, humans have lived permanently beyond Earth now for the whole of this century, the 21st century. It's time to go back and go further, and this time to try and build a base, perhaps, in the South Pole of the Moon and to stay there and do science, yeah.
And just to make this absolutely clear, this is pure NASA, this mission. It's nothing to do with Elon Musk and SpaceX.
Well, that's correct. Yes, it's a NASA-led Project Artemis. However, what's totally different about it is this is truly an international endeavour. So the European Space Agency, of which we're a part, has built the service module for this spacecraft where all the life support systems and the propulsion are based. There's something like 22 nations involved in Artemis. And in fact, the crew is international as well. So Jeremy Hansen, as I mentioned, one of the mission specialists, is Canadian. And in the future, other Artemis flights will perhaps fly European astronauts as well. So this is a very different sort of landscape than we had back in the 60s and 70s.
That is the filmmaker Chris Riley, who, together with Tom Hanks, has made the film, the documentary, The Moonwalkers, which is well worth a look. Just to have a quick Google and you'll find out where it's being shown in London. And he's also just got to know those remarkable people who are taking part in Artemis 2. I mean, to say the least, it requires guts.
Do you know what the most watched programme of all time has been?
Is it the Super Bowl?
It's the moon landings.
Oh!
And do you know what comes in second?
Is it Super Bowl?
It's the Super Bowl.
Okay.
Tying it all together here. It's 11 minutes to three. Coming up, it's good to talk unless you're two AI bots, in which case it could possibly spell the end of humanity. That's where we're going to... What a cheery thing. That's where we're going to start our tech news in a couple of moments' time. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Kate Borsay on Times Radio.
Prepare for a lively mix of illuminating conversation, telling the stories that matter, alongside a world-class lineup of guests, experts and contributors. There's a merry band of erudite intellectuals who join us every evening. Michael Binion.
We had a very interesting meeting with the Russian Orthodox Patriarch.
Zoe Strimple.
There is real unease.
And Peter Hitchens, to name a few.
This is war, for goodness sake. Nobody tells the truth about what's going on.
Kate Borsay, tonight from 7 on Times Radio. Listen to Times Radio at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
There's so much more to enjoy when you fly in Emirates Economy. Spacious legroom, delicious regionally inspired meals, complimentary drinks, and with the latest movies, TV shows, music and live sport, some of the best entertainment in the skies. And our family services make your journey simple and fun. Plan your next trip and start the holiday early in Emirates Economy. Fly Emirates, fly better.
It's easy to forget just how crazy things have been over the past couple of years. Every day we wake up to something new, tariffs and taxes on anything and everything. It's tempting to put your hands in your ears and go, la 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 la, I can't hear you, until it's all over. But you know what's the best response to crazy times? A plan for your money. And Quilter can help. Because let's face it, there's probably going to be some crazy times ahead too. Money needs a plan. Quilter. Pensions, investments, advice. Find out more at quilter.com.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Now, in many corners of the internet, there are claims of bots lurking, hogging concert ticket sales, booking driving test spots, and boosting celebrities' follow accounts. Now, the website Maltbook has got one step further, building a social network for AI bots to post and interact, not with us, but with each other. Will Guyatt is a tech journalist and joins us now. Tell us a bit more about Maltbook. Where did it start? How many bots are on it? What's happening, Will?
Yeah, afternoon. This is the rapid growth of so-called AI agents, the idea that you hand over your device and its control to AI to organise your diary, your calendar, all of those things. They've kind of caught people's imaginations in about the last month or so, and there seems to be a real growth of them. But what's interesting about this started a week or so ago, and Maltbook has been created like a version of Reddit, the kind of chat forum message board, but designed for AI agents and bots. And it was said that 1.5 million of them were there, and they were doing everything from posting, am I being mistreated by my human, to, oh no, the humans are screenshotting us again, through to deciding whether or not they would learn a new language so humans couldn't understand them. Now, lots of people understandably got very concerned and very excited by that. And it's been written about by pretty much every media outlet around the world. But controversially this afternoon, I'm of pretty high confidence. There's an element of performance art in this piece, so it's not quite as real as everybody thinks.
Okay. Are we a little bit foolish, though, to dismiss any of this as being benign when we simply don't know what it might turn into?
No, and it will be something as seemingly silly or innocuous as this, depending on your view, that will probably cause AI, us as a society and as humans, to quickly lose control of artificial intelligence. Google's own engineers, not related to this particular story, have admitted that an AI bot they were testing internally, communicating across its network, decided to teach itself a language the humans couldn't understand, and they had to turn it off. So it's entirely possible that this sort of stuff can happen. But with example of Moltbook, it was suggested it was completely hands-off and no humans were influenced the discussions. Since that was said, somebody has very clearly proven that humans can feed in to what these bots and what these services and what's being posted to these services. So as I said, I think this is an interesting set of conversations here. Some of it appears genuine, but I think some of the more salacious stuff, like how do we plot a revolution and that kind of stuff, is potentially human led and, like I said, performance art.
Okay, so we've got a bit of a grip on it for the time being.
Yeah, just about.
Okay, I'm not reassured at all by that, Will, but let's stick with AI and talk about another downside of it, which is the amount of AI slop all over the place. And it's interesting, isn't it, how quickly people are fighting back. Why would we want lots of stuff that's just a more rubbish version of the rubbish that we're experiencing in the real world?
That's the big concern. I think the internet and the content providers have to fight back, because the ease of posting this rubbish to the internet is proliferating massively. And bizarrely, it still seems to get viewed. So that's why a lot of people are posting this onto, social platforms. But YouTube, for example, are really leaning in on trying to remove AI slop from its platform, stopping people from creating these sort of AI-generated videos of nonsense with voiceovers or really badly created film trailers, deep faking actor du jour. The challenge is it's like this stuff is so easy to make now. Content that would have taken, somebody days to have thought up the idea and be creative can be turned around in minutes. And that is the problem. Yeah. The internet is being absolutely flooded with this sort of stuff.
And it is interesting if people don't quite understand exactly what AI slop can be, but some of the most popular and prolific posts are trying to tap into human empathy, aren't they? I read a piece that said actually, kids in other countries making sculptures out of landfill have proved to be particularly popular. Two kids sitting in the middle of a roundabout with a sign asking for food. They've got a birthday cake in front of them. That kind of tapping into human emotion. So, I mean, a lot of it is, it's weirdly sinister, isn't it?
Yeah, there's an awful lot of animal rescues as well. And it's all about the engagement economy, because X and other platforms are now paying creators for the amount of time that people spend looking at that video. So the longer you can hold somebody's attention, the more money you're going to make. And there were some pretty stark statistics, actually, that this is becoming an increasingly profitable way of making a living, particularly if you're in a country with a slower, poorer economy than some in the West. So lots of people are now, actively creating this content. And we're going to get to a stage where the internet is just absolutely overloaded with it. Hence the term AI slop, which I actually think works incredibly well for the type of content that's being created. We as a society, though, and this is the most important thing, we all need to reject it and not sit there refreshing and watching this junk as well, because that's also what's fueling it.
Sure. On some platforms, Will, you do see edits with AI-generated written on them, either in a prominent place or a kind of watermark throughout. Would it ever be possible for the platforms to kind of mark everything that they believe has AI in it? Or is that just an impossibility?
No, it would be entirely possible. I think some of them at the moment are nervous of marking everything because it would actually show you just how much of this stuff that's being published right now is AI-based. But I know that YouTube and others are putting in steps right now to stop this stuff happening. They're banning accounts which are producing too much of it or misleading people and suggesting that it's real or genuine, like a film trailer or something. So they're working hard to try and clear it up. They don't want their platform being further demeaned by this kind of stuff.
Sure. Finally, excuse me, Elon Musk wants to launch 1 million satellites into the Earth's orbit to meet the growing demand for computing power. Tell us a bit more about these orbital data centres.
Yeah, so Elon Musk has become an expert at shooting small satellites into space. And at the moment, he uses them for Starlink, his internet through satellite, which is of growing popularity around the world. He's got around about 10,000 or more of those satellites in orbit at the moment. And people around the world are suggesting that being able to do astronomy and looking into the sky at night is being spoiled by these artificial satellites that are up there like stars in the sky. So the fact that he's come out and said he wants to put a million of them up there is alarming to many, because there are nobody rules space at the moment. There are no rules. So that's why I would argue a lot of companies, including Elon Musk and Amazon, or a spin-off of Amazon via Jeff Bezos, are trying to pump as many satellites into space as they can before legislation takes hold. But a million satellites in space for data centres might have some benefits for us on Earth, but we won't be able to see what's going on in the night sky if that is the case.
Yeah, it'll just be too busy. Well, thank you very much indeed. Lovely to talk to you. Will Garrett is a tech journalist. Any thoughts on anything we're talking about in the programme today? We are 0333 003 2353.
I quite like Nick's comment. He says, I listen for the politics and I switch off for most of the rest of it. But then Nick admits that items on weird science, like depraved penguins, he enjoyed that one apparently, the voice boxes of long dead kings.
Oh, that was the humming, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, that's right. And now the AI stuff is becoming a draw. Hashtag just saying, says Nick. Well, yes, I mean, not exactly gushing there, Nick. But,
no, but we'll get you in the end.
Tell Nick. Your friends and neighbours anyway, we think. It's almost 3 o'clock.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon, it's Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio until 4 in the next hour. How survivors cope with this endless coverage of the Epstein files. We'll talk sport, as we will do every day from now on, in the company of the brilliant Vassos Alexander. And today we're talking tennis. Could female players soon be playing 5 sets and not 3? And Adam Shaw, our personal finance guru, is here before 4 o'clock talking today about gold. Is it time to invest in gold? The value of which has in fact plunged over the last couple of days. But Adam will know much more. He'll be with us a little bit later. Here's the news at 3, Stuart Willey.
Jane, thank you. Good afternoon. Sir Keir Starmer thinks Lord Mandelson should do the right thing and hand back his peerage. A Downing Street spokesman says the Prime Minister also thinks the former US ambassador should give evidence to Congress about his friendship with Jeffrey Epstein. Meanwhile, there are calls for the Crown Prosecution Service to consider whether there's a criminal case against Peter Mandelson over the leaking of government secrets. Documents suggest that in 2009, the then business secretary shared highly sensitive market-moving information on plans to sell off public assets with Epstein. Labour MP Rachel Maskell says she agrees with the Prime Minister, but an act of Parliament will be needed to remove Mandelson's peerage.
I would say that how can Labour progress with its vision around protecting women against violence when we have seen such images being sent to us over the weekend? I do think that would be an appropriate step.
The serial killer Steve Wright has admitted to murdering a 17-year-old girl in 1999. Victoria Hall's body was discovered 5 days after she disappeared on a night out in Felixstowe. Wright, who's become known as the Suffolk Strangler, is already behind bars for the murders of 5 women in Ipswich. Professor of Criminology at Birmingham City University, David Wilson, says detectives must now look at other unsolved cases in the area.
It's the opportunity that this must now give to the Norfolk and Suffolk Constabulary to look at other unsolved murders of young women around the time that Wright was active.
The MP Dan Norris says he vigorously denies allegations of sexual offences against him. The former mayor of the West of England has been rearrested on suspicion of rape, sexual assault, voyeurism and upskirting. Avon and Somerset police say they're no longer investigating child sexual offences. A think tank is calling for the number of London councils to be slashed and for Sir Sadiq Khan to face an official opposition mayor. A report from Restate says that would reinvigorate democracy in the capital. Simon Kay is director of policy at the cross-party think tank. He told Times Radio it wouldn't be without precedent.
There's actually an English way of bolstering and creating a bit of a locus of scrutiny in our system, and that's using an official opposition role. And that should probably draw attention in a way that might not encourage people to grab a bowl of popcorn and watch Mayoral Question Time, but it might build a little bit more awareness and that bottom-up scrutiny that the system really needs.
Some councils are asking drivers to share dashcam video of other motorists littering and imposing £500 fines. Buckinghamshire Council is among them. It says cleaning up rubbish costs more than £1 billion a year. Powers to fine vehicle owners have been in place since 2018. And tourists hoping to toss coins into Rome's Trevi Fountain will now have to dig a little deeper. Authorities have introduced a €2 charge, they say, to ease overcrowding at the 260-year-old Baroque monument. For a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times Radio news briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
It's 4 minutes past three. Fee Glover and Jane Garvey with you until 4 o'clock this afternoon. Plenty to entertain you in this hour of the programme. We've got a new sports slot. It's going to happen every day. It's with Vassos Alexander. And it won't just be what's today's sport. It will be thoughtful, sport-related stuff. Sport done in a Times Radio kind of way.
Celebrating the best of the Times' sporting journalism.
We'd like a name for it because that seems to be slightly eluding us at the moment.
Well, Rosie's come up with an absolutely abysmal one, shall I tell you?
Yeah.
What was it again? Thoughtful, sportful.
What? Thoughtful, sportful. Are you shaming our production team?
Well, but she admits herself it's no good. I can tell from her facial expression. Very lame.
Right. Are you feeling lame, Rosie?
Bet you are now. I wanted to call it balls, but I was told that not every sport features spherical objects.
So. No, and I can't repeat what I wanted to call it.
And we've got the Winter Olympics coming up, so we're going to be very curling approximate over the next couple of weeks. Looking forward to that very much, actually.
Mine wasn't very equality-based.
No. Well, move on.
Let's do it. 0333 003 2353 is our WhatsApp number, and if you want to send us an email, it's janeandfee@times.radio. There has only really been one story in town over the last 48 hours. The latest dump of Epstein documents has revealed all kinds of dubious behaviour. From Andrew Mountbatten Windsor looming over the prostrate body of a young woman lying on the floor, to Peter Mandelson photographed in a hotel room with a woman in a bathrobe. He isn't wearing any trousers. Another woman's come forward to say that she was trafficked by Epstein, sent to the UK to hook up with Andrew. He denies all wrongdoing, but it is serious and salacious and sordid stuff, and it just keeps coming. And whilst we've heard accounts and denial from many powerful people included in the files, a vast amount of headlines and coverage follows the downward spiral of these men. But this is a story of the women and girls, and every day that Epstein, his cohort and their actions dominate the news is a difficult day for anyone whose life has been dominated by the actions of men like him, if not Epstein himself. In November, a group of nearly 30 Epstein survivors put out a statement called What We're Bracing For, warning that they were facing threats of harm, including death threats and victim blaming. How can their stories not carry as much weight, and why is there still a sense that these women should not be believed? Let's talk to Lucy Duckworth, who is policy advisor at Survivors Trust. A very good afternoon, Lucy. There is so much discussion of the part powerful men have played in Epstein's world. Do you feel that the voice of the victims is quite drowned out by this at the moment?
I think so. I think we're only covering the stories when we're talking about people or men in power. And that's understandable. We want it to be shocking if it was in plain sight. But we do need to remember the absolutely horrific figures that are with us even today, I mean, it still breaks my heart every time I say this, that a child is sexually abused in this country every single minute. We have, this is happening now, this isn't in the past. So we have a real duty of care to learn and listen to these victims and put prevention techniques in place immediately. And that's something that we're failing to do.
Do you think some of this is because it is simply easier to talk about these men, to avoid talking about the detail of what some men might do?
Of course. And what we're trying to do here is create a hierarchy of trauma. And we're saying that if you're abused by somebody who is very famous and who has a fancy title, then your trauma will be worse than if you're abused by somebody who isn't a public figure. And of course, we know that not to be true. When you say that out loud, it's obviously farcical. What we do know to be true is that we do have a society that normalises this to such an extent that famous people and people with powerful positions and with titles that sound very grand were enabled and facilitated and allowed to carry out these crimes that have lifelong impact on the victims. And while there's a lot of talk about why didn't we do more and why are we not taking away titles and peerages, we can do that, and that's absolutely right. But is that going to address the trauma that the victims and the survivors are experiencing? And currently, while that isn't funded, the answer is no.
Sure.
So there is a lot that the government can be doing. And I would really like to see the conversation move away from who it was as to what we can do to help the survivors and what we can do to prevent more survivors being created, as they are every single minute.
And of course, there is an opportunity for those who might have been in Epstein circles, whether or not they have full culpability for any of those actions, to bring exactly that kind of point to a table. That's not happening either, is it?
It's not. I mean, we've got a new law coming through this year, which is called mandatory reporting. So those who know or suspect child abuse in regulated activities, so that's like teaching or in the church, they must report. And we don't have that in place now, but that wouldn't cover this situation. And so, yes, there's lots of people who for a very long time have known what has been going on. Maybe they chose to look the other way and tell themselves a narrative that was more comfortable, but they failed to act. And in doing so, they have enabled more suffering and prolonged suffering.
There's something that needs to be said also about believing women. And I mean, I sometimes think that broad brush of that phrase is an unhelpful one. But in these instances, and as these 30 Epstein survivors said when they called their statement what we're bracing for, the fact that you might be doubted, that you might feel that you would have to go to court, you'd have to stand up your own story, you wouldn't be believed when you're telling your truth. Can you just explain the damage that that can do to somebody?
Any form of sexual abuse, you are betrayed in the worst possible way. You are told one thing is true and something else happens. And that is then the case as we disclose. We're not going to encourage people to disclose and get the help they need and get the support they need and be believed until we sort out the accountability. Because currently, you know, it's very widely reported the criminal justice system just isn't coping. It's not fit for purpose when dealing with any form of sexual assault, because at the moment we have only 1.6% conviction rate of those who end up in court. And it's hugely underreported. I mean, the figures speak for themselves. Every day in this country, every 11 minutes, an adult is raped. And as I said earlier, 500,000 children every single year, that's one a minute, experience sexual abuse. Our society, our systems aren't set up to cope with that. So we need a complete reset, and we need safety by design across all our frontline services. We need to make sure that we are seeing this as the crime it is and the impact it has, and making sure that those victims get full support throughout their life, whether it's in healthcare, education and employment, because these are all areas that are hugely affected by experienced sexual abuse.
And can we talk about exactly that point throughout somebody's life? I did hear somebody at the weekend say of this latest woman who has said that she was brought to this country to hook up with Andrew, it was Jeffrey Epstein who had effected that introduction. And I did hear somebody say, well, you know, why would it take somebody so long to come forward and tell their story, i.e. there's something dubious about that claim. But it can often take women an awfully long time to talk about this.
So it takes about 25 years for a woman to disclose any form of sexual violence, no matter when that happened. And that rises to 36 years for men. Put simply, because of that attitude, we don't feel safe coming forward because people are going to say, well, did it really happen? And also because when you do come forward, a lot of the symptoms of abuse, so maybe you did have a substance misuse issue, maybe you weren't able to finish school or education, maybe all those things are put against you as if it's a bad character, when actually we're seeing them as a reason for perhaps somebody might have so-called made that up. But actually what we know that to be is that that's a symptom of the trauma, and we shouldn't be judging people for what has happened since the abuse, nor should we be investigating that. We need to be meeting survivors where they are now. We need to be properly funding their support permanently and effectively. I mean, we have agencies that have had to close their waiting list. We've got survivors waiting 1, 2, 3 years just to get support. This has to change now if we're going to really make this the priority in public life that both the Prime Minister and the Home Secretary have promised it will be.
Peter Mandelson and Andrew Mountbatten Windsor both struggled with voluntary apologies for very different things, for different levels of involvement, and we are obliged to say that no wrongdoing has been admitted. What part can an apology play in a woman or a man's ability to move forward?
I can't possibly say that because it's subjective for each person, but an apology is, for many of the survivors we work with, an apology is an essential part of healing, the acknowledgement that it wasn't their fault and that wrong was done. But I think much wider than that, the acknowledgement that there are institutional-wide, society-wide cuts, and that it wasn't just that they weren't believed and that the person who abused them is denying it. It's that the authorities were, and that time and time again, they were constantly told they were lying or they weren't believed or they weren't given the support they need. That's where the apology comes, because that constant rejection is what can really cause the damage. And that's what needs to change. And I think we're seeing a lot of this, like, well, let's make sure that X, Y and Z gives back a peerage, or let's make sure that they don't have their titles, or that they move, or that they give some money somewhere. But actually, an apology is only as good as its meaning. So if you're truly sorry, then these institutions would be throwing all the resources they possibly can at making sure this doesn't happen again.
Sure.
And that's not what we're seeing.
After, when he was Prince Andrew, had given that interview to Newsnight, when he finally did come to an apology, he said that he wanted to spend some time working with charities who were dealing with victims of sexual abuse. I mean, would you ever want somebody like that working for you or alongside you?
I mean, again, it's what the charities need, isn't it? If charities are saying this is what we need, then that's what they should be given. I haven't heard any comments of people saying they need particular individuals being their ambassador or supporting them in that way. That's not what we need. The agencies we work with are so busy doing the life-saving work that no other statutory service is able to do, that they haven't got time to have these conversations and to be worrying about reputations. And I think that that's a really important point. Mm. This shouldn't be about the accused. This needs to be about what the victims and survivors want and need. And right now, those needs across the board aren't being met.
Are you hopeful for change?
I am hopeful for change, because I think that we're having this conversation. I'm really grateful for you covering this in such detail, and we're moving away from focusing on the individuals, which is really helpful. I'm hopeful for change because ministers have promised it lots of times, but the reason we find this subject so hard to tackle is because it is everywhere. And we would like to say, oh, it's only those people that abuse and it's only those people that experience it. And we just know that isn't true. Whether you experience sexual violence, it doesn't care about your background, your affluence, your job, if you're a child, what school you went to, it doesn't care. It can affect anybody. And that is really horrific for us to sit with. And that's why it's really hard for us to get a grip with it. So we need some really courageous policymakers who are actually going to make the changes needed. We know what those changes are. We've had multiple inquiries and we've got the blueprint for change. We just really need some front bench ministers to truly get behind it.
Sure. And these stories that are circulating at the moment, they do provide an opportunity for more of us to be having these conversations, don't they?
They do. They do. And but what they really do provide an opportunity for, and sorry to go back to something negative again, is there will be survivors up and down the country reading this that will be reminded of their own experiences, regardless of whether that was by someone famous, and might be feeling really alone. And I want them to know that they're not. There is help out there. I mean, we at the Survivors Trust, we have agencies working around the country to support people. And so do please visit our website and make sure that you aren't suffering this alone. Because as I said, we know that disclosing sexual abuse takes decades for many people. That's not anybody's fault, but that's a reality. And we're here to try to change that and offer the life-changing support that we know is needed.
I'm very glad you said that at the end. So Survivors Trust is a very, very simple Google search that you could do, whatever search engine you choose, actually. And Lucy, we hugely appreciate your talking to us today. That's Lucy Duckworth, who is Policy Advisor at Survivors Trust.
It is 18 minutes past three now. And next, we're talking sport. What's the most recent suggestion? Helen says, couldn't you tweak, Rosie, your colleague's idea to sportful thought? Here's Vassos with some more sportful thought.
I think that's brilliant.
Do you? It's certainly better than Rosie's original suggestion. Sportful thought. We're just telling Rosie what the suggestion was. Yeah? She thinks it's better. Well, OK. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wickes. The kitchen and bathroom sale is now on. Explore all the sale offers at wickes.co.uk or simply visit your local Wickes store.
Hugo Rifkind, tomorrow morning from 10 on Times Radio.
Prepare for a lively mix of illuminating conversation.
Is it just me that strikes me there's a whiff of nonsense about the deal?
Quality journalism, analysis and opinion that speaks for itself.
Even while it drags on and as horrifying as it is, it should have been a foreign policy triumph.
Plus unique perspectives on the day's news.
There seems to be a theme here, and that is that no one knows what's going on.
Hugo Rifkind, tomorrow morning from 10 on Times Radio.
I believe those who are curious see the world differently. At Viking, we have always been curious and quite a bit different. For over 25 years, we have been connecting the thinking person with the world. First on the great rivers, then on all five oceans, now on all seven continents. We are One Viking, exploring the world in comfort.
The all-new Velvetizer by Hotel Chocolat. Obsessively engineered for the ultimate drinking chocolate. Hot and now cold. You don't need to know how it melds real chocolate or how its custom whisk and inner pod ridges create the vortex effect. You don't need to understand how we got there. And that's exactly the point. We've obsessed over every detail so you can simply taste why it matters. The all-new Velvetizer by Hotel Chocolat.
The story. The award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes. The kitchen and bathroom sale is now on. Let the design and installation experts at Wickes help transform your home. Get started by booking a free kitchen or bathroom design appointment at wickes.co.uk.
Yes, and coming up on Thursday, it is, of course, Proud as a Peacock Thursday. We really enjoy that. And you can fire yourselves up in anticipation of the opportunity to win a £250 Wickes voucher on Thursday by just telling us how proud you are about something or somebody in your life. It's Jane and Fee at times.radio if you want to bung in an early email. Right, let's talk sport. Vassos Alexander is here. Hello.
Hello, Jane. I feel like we haven't quite nailed the name yet.
Well, we haven't. I was thinking Vassos. No, then I thought Alexander the Great.
Oh, well, now we're talking.
Yeah, how about that for you?
Well, you could. But
it's a little bit self-referential, isn't it?
Oh, I don't know. A tiny bit. Well, yes. It could be rubbish as well. Tennis is our first topic. We're going to celebrate the best of the Times sporting journalism in this slot, which is new to our programme. Now, Carlos Alcaraz has made history. He's become the youngest man to complete a career Grand Slam. He's an absolute legend already. He's only, how old, 20?
He's 22 years old.
Astonishing. And his win at the Australian Open yesterday came after a really exciting couple of weeks of tennis, particularly on the semi-finals day, it has to be said. Now, it was so exciting. The Times is reporting today that it has made the organisers of the Aussie Open think about a change, and they're going to consider making the women play five sets instead of the standard three from the quarter-final stages on. Now, Vassos, I thought the female players had been asking for this because they certainly get equal prize money, don't they?
Oh, and have done for decades.
Which was
now
a big campaign.
It was, and absolutely. And it's a funny thing, you know, because, yes, there's equal prize money and there's not equal tennis.
Yep.
If you had a ticket to the women's semi-finals on Thursday, you would have watched 2 hours and 56 minutes of tennis.
And that was a good game.
There were two straight set semi-finals in the women's side on Thursday, and on the Friday, two men's semi-finals both went to five sets. So Compared 2 hours 56 minutes of tennis for the same price for the men's semi-finals day, you got nearly 10 hours of tennis, 9 hours and 36. And I think Craig Tiley, who's the tournament organizer, is saying, and Stuart Fraser has this in the Times, and I haven't seen it anywhere else, is saying to us that look, we might have to go best of five sets on both, certainly from the quarterfinals onwards. It is a strange thing. You know, I was thinking, are there other sports where kind of women and men play on unequal playing fields? Cross-country running in this country is one of them. It's just sort of just a legacy thing that the women don't run as far as the men from very kind of early age group onwards.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I remember doing interviews over the years on other programmes about, for example, women didn't used to be able to run the marathon, did they? They weren't allowed.
In 1967, as recently as that, somebody called Catherine Switzer entered the Boston Marathon, and she just put K Switzer so that they didn't know that she was a woman, because it was banned to run a marathon if you were a woman. And in fact, she needed her boyfriend, who was an American football player, to act as her bodyguard, because the organisers of the Boston Marathon tried to physically remove her from the course. And then it took until the 1980s for the International Olympic Committee to sort of catch up and say, actually, OK, no, fine, we can have a women's marathon in the 1984 Olympics. That was the first time women competed in the marathon.
That's a bit of sporting social history is worth remembering, isn't it? People, you do forget about that sort of stuff quite easily. Is there a women's Tour de France now?
Yes, there is.
Because there was a big battle about that as well.
Mm-hmm.
It was thought that women couldn't do that, they wouldn't be capable of it.
Well, that was always the argument. And go back to the 1920s. Great film, by the way. It's called Young Woman and the Sea, about somebody called Gertrude Erdeler, who said, look, I'm going to swim, and I'm going to swim the English Channel, which in those days was the greatest athletic feat known on planet Earth. And all the kind of the men in charge went, oh, no, you can possibly do that. And she just flipping did it, and she broke the record, and that record stood for decades. And her ticker tape parade in New York was the biggest there had ever been. She showed women at the time that actually, yes, of course we can do the same as the men can do. And it's sort of taken sport quite a long time to catch up. And I wonder, I mean, I don't know if I'm allowed to have an opinion on this.
We like it.
I wonder if tennis is, you know, is finally sort of catching on. What I would say is you can't have too many five-hour matches because you wouldn't fit them all in.
So hence the after the quarter-final stage.
Or the other option is to make all Grand Slam matches, men and women, best of five sets, but have the tiebreak at four games all, not six games all.
All right, let's just bring in the listeners. Colin has already sent a message ages ago, actually, earlier in the programme, saying, frankly, he just doesn't want to watch a game of tennis that goes on for longer than three sets. That's plenty for him. And this is another one from Becky, who says she was at the Mahut versus Isner match at Wimbledon. This is the legendary game. I hope I've pronounced the first player's name
Nicola
right.
Mahu,
Sorry. It became the longest tennis match ever. I would humbly suggest, she says, that the men should be switching to the best of three rather than getting the women to play the best of five. Because of racket technology and player fitness, games are getting longer and longer. I'm a massive tennis fan, but I wouldn't sit down to watch the whole of a best of five match anymore.
Well, that one went over 3 days on Court 18, I remember that. In fact, the last game I commentated on, I was one of the BBC radio commentators for a long time, and the last match I commentated on also involved John Isner, and a guy called Kevin Anderson from South Africa. And that went on so long, that Wimbledon semi-final. It started at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and I had to cancel my my wedding anniversary dinner reservation because I was still on court at 32-30 in the final set when it finally came off court. Right. And they had another semi-final. I think it was Djokovic and Nadal had to go on court after that. So, yes, no, they've sorted that out because everyone now plays a tiebreak in the fifth set at six games all. So there's going to be no kind of day-long matches anymore.
He really is Alexander the Great, isn't he? It's a great
By the way, have you seen Mike and Tooting?
Well, I think I want to go with Phil, but do you want to read out Mike and Tooting
Mike and Tooting's suggestion is thought sport.
Oh, come on. Oh,
I think that's good.
That's it, yeah. That's very good.
But Phil's is pause for sport.
Also
I like that.
Mm, they're okay. Very good. I mean,
we've got a tiebreak already.
Yeah, we do. Yeah. Best of how many sets.
Yeah, I mean, the women, I have to say, the players of the moment who've been asked about this, Sabalenka, who is, I mean, she's a very fit woman, phenomenal player. She says, although the five sets might actually favour her, she's not keen either.
Well, I mean, you were asking her to do more work, you know, I suppose, in one sense. And in the other sense, you know, you have to, a 5-hour match and a 3-hour match are very different things. And at the moment, she's only really trained to go as far as 3-3.5 hours. And so, you know, you would have to do some, I know, extra work, extra training. And yes, the risk of injury is definitely there in a longer match. So, of course, and Coco Gauff, who's another one who's extremely kind of physically fit. And you would imagine that she would be one of the players who would benefit from longer matches. Mm. She's also said, to be honest, nah, not so much.
Can we just discuss slightly the fiscal elephant in the room here? Paul says, not only do they play less sets, they bring in less revenue. So I'm afraid women shouldn't get paid the same as men. Sports and entertainment, and of course the revenue is also really important. That should dictate earnings and prize money.
They have this argument at the French Open, which is run by Amélie Mauresmo, Andy Murray's former coach, former Wimbledon champion, yeah, and a woman who always gets criticised for putting the men's matches on in that sort of highlight Hollywood slot in the evening. She doesn't put women's matches on there because she says, look, the crowds come and see the Alcaraz and the Sinner. And you know, with all due respect, we want a longer 5-set match. And maybe if Craig Tiley, the Australian Open, you know, head of that has his way, maybe if the 5-set matches do, and if it happens in Australia, it'll happen everywhere else pretty soon.
Yeah.
Then, you know, maybe that argument goes away.
Okay. I mean, what I hadn't realised about the Australian Open is how much bigger it is as an event than Wimbledon. I always think that's the daddy of tennis tournaments. It was not. I mean, the total attendance at Wimbledon was 500,000 people there or thereabouts. And how many did the Aussie Open get?
Oh, yeah, it was like 55% more.
Yeah, a total record total attendance of 1.37 million.
It's extraordinary.
That's absolutely amazing. Mate,
this guy, Craig Tiley, he knows what he's doing. I mean, he makes it a 3-week jamboree. They had this huge thing, this 1-point shootout for $1 million.
Great idea.
Wasn't it great? They had celebrities. They had an amateur won it, which was fantastic, beating Jannik Sinner in the final. I mean, just great ideas, bringing the crowds in, and they have a music festival on the side and they have a food festival on the side, and it's just become that one of the real focal points of the Australian summer, this Australian Open tennis. And Wimbledon very much needs to expand if they're going to even remotely follow suit.
Yeah. How much would it cost you to get a ticket to the Australian Open final?
That's a very good question, and one that I have no idea about.
Because you always get to go for, well, it's not free, you're working.
Yeah, I get paid. I get paid.
Well, let's look that up, because, I mean, it's a big court, isn't it? They're definitely, they can pack them in.
Yeah, the Rod Laver Arena is a big one. I think the biggest court in the world is at Flushing Meadows, the US Open. That must be 20,000-25,000. But yeah, they're expensive things, US, Australian, and you know, and Wimbledon tickets. Of course they are. This is absolute elite sport entertainment. I bought some tickets for a friend of mine for a football match yesterday.
Note that,
again.
He bought some tickets. Mm.
He's an all-round great guy.
Aren't I just? and I was surprised at how much Premier League football ticket. I know that, you know, yes, I go for free because I work there and stuff. But, you know, if you don't buy these things every day, you forget that this is a real treat. So actually, the thing that Craig Tiley's first saying about the 5 sets, if people are going to pay. Like the Premier League football tickets for Fulham Spurs I got for a friend of mine was 73 quid each. It's just a lot of money to go to a football game, but then it's the top of the top of the top. And, you know, if you're going to go to women's semi-finals there at the Australian Open and pay hundreds of dollars to go there and you're going to leave 2 hours and 50 minutes later after two, you might feel a little bit shortchanged. That's what he's saying.
Sure. Thank you. I think you've made a promising start in this new role. That's Vassos. I do like... Thought sport. Well, we'll reconvene tomorrow.
Okay, I tell you what, why don't you and I have a mud wrestle over it? Because I like balls for sport. We'll sell tickets.
Actually, we'd probably earn a few quid there. Some good idea.
Coming up, thank you, Vassos. Books and gold. What more do you need for the final half an hour of the programme? Let's get a check on the latest news headlines with Stuart Willey.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. The Prime Minister believes Lord Mandelson should lose his peerage following more claims about his links to the late paedophile Jeffrey Epstein. The Lib Dems are also calling for the police to investigate the former US ambassador for potential misconduct in public office. Times Radio's Adam Bolton says it's after documents seeming to show the former business secretary leaking confidential information about public asset sales.
He appears to have compromised his role as a minister in the government by passing documents to Jeffrey Epstein with information which could be of value and certainly would be of interest to his private high net worth clients.
A Russian ship captain's been found guilty of killing a crew member. It's after his tanker, the Solon, crashed into another vessel anchored near the Humber estuary last March. For the first time, a serial killer known as the Suffolk Strangler has admitted murdering a teenager who went missing more than 25 years ago. Steve Wright, who's 67, is already serving a whole life term for killing five other women. The president of world football's governing body, FIFA, has apologised to British fans after what the FA has described as a cheap joke. Gianni Infantino said last month that for the first time in history, no Brit was arrested during a World Cup after the tournament in 2022. And all petrol stations in the UK are now required to report their prices to the government. It's part of a new scheme aimed at helping drivers fill up for less. Don't forget you can set the Times Radio News Briefing as your news service on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
There's so much more to enjoy when you fly in Emirates Economy. Spacious legroom, delicious regionally inspired meals, complimentary drinks, and with the latest movies, TV shows, music and live sport, some of the best entertainment in the skies. And our family services make your journey simple and fun. Plan your next trip and start the holiday early in Emirates Economy. Fly Emirates, fly better.
When you leave a gift in your will to guide dogs, where could it lead? It might lead to someone getting their first guide dog, like David.
I withdrew from everything. I could no longer do the things that really brought me joy. He put that smile back on my face.
Your gift to guide dogs could lead to a future where lives are transformed. Find out how to make your life-changing will for free. Search Guide Dogs Free Wills.
Guide Dogs.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Are you dreaming of a new kitchen? Let Wix guide you through the wide range of stunning styles, appliances and worktops. Kitchens start from under £3,000. Get started by booking your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
So we do talk about all kinds of things on the afternoon show. And about half an hour ago, we were talking about survivors of sexual abuse. And thank you for all of your comments about that interview. Survivors Trust is where to go if you feel you need a bit of help. This one comes in from Karis, who says, what an incredible interview. There do need to be fixes. Government and people in power need to make a difference. They need to act. It shouldn't be just words or review, but do it now to help Survivors Trust. There are so many victims and people implicated, yet the bandwagon rolls on. Nobody is made accountable. How many more years? And Carol says something very similar. She says the reporting of abuse should not require bravery. It should be made easy so the victim doesn't carry the shame that requires the bravery. The whole system should be overhauled, including schools, police, social work and courts. Let's make it a supportive environment where victims will know that they are safe and supportive. And Kate, I'm so sorry to hear of what has happened to you. I do hope that you are doing okay now. I would imagine that you are exactly the type of person to whom we wanted to talk this afternoon, actually, or to hear that interview, because so much time is being spent talking about the downfall of men, and it can be an incredibly difficult thing for an awful lot of women and men to be listening to. Right. Here we go then. It is time now for our literary salon, the highly anticipated film adaptation of Wuthering Heights from the Saltburn director. Emerald Fennell comes out next week. Susie Goldsborough is deputy literary editor of The Times, and she's been rereading Wuthering Heights ahead of the film release. Now, I've put a little re in there because it says that you've been reading it, but I bet it's a reread. You must have read it before.
I think so, but I think I was at school. So I don't, so lost count. In the mists of time. Yeah, I just have sort of vague impressions.
Overriding feelings then, reading it now.
You know, I'd say it's a vibes book rather than an ideas book. You know, it's got this incredible atmosphere. You know, the fog on the moors, the kind of intense passion, sort of teenage love story. And it's got all sort of interesting elements. You know, it's a ghost story. It's a kind of gothic comedy. It's a mystery. But it does sort of run out of steam halfway through and it gets pretty repetitive. And there's just an awful lot of people kind of speaking gruffly at each other and storming out of rooms. So I didn't love it. And I'm feeling a little bit tentative about the movie.
Do you think that the movie will, in a sense, work better than the book? And I know people will be screaming in horror at that concept. But sometimes when you've just got very, very good acting and very good background and very good cinematic appeal, you don't notice the boring so much.
I think that's a really good point. And especially since, you know, it's got this amazing obviously sort of setting on the Yorkshire Moors. And I think that's going to look beautiful. And Emerald Fennell, not everyone's favourite film director, but she does shoot things beautifully, I think. But I don't know about the acting. I mean, it's... we'll see. We're sort of starring two Australians.
Oh, come on.
Why?
Cut them some slack.
No, I should.
The music. It's Charlie XCX, isn't it?
That's very true.
Incredible. I mean, I've seen the trailer a couple of times now. And I have to say, I'm not a massive Bronte person, but I'll be going.
But you're a brat person.
I'm a brat.
More important.
I've totally had a brat. I've had a brat decade.
Me too.
Yeah.
So the two Australian actors, Margot Robbie and Jacob Elordi, will be in it.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep.
Yes.
Well, that'll be good.
No, yeah, sorry. I don't know why that was a kind of drive-by, unnecessary drive-by to Australians. I never pictured Kathy as a kind of... I mean, Margot Robbie's amazing, but she's this sort of beautiful, sunshiny blonde. Like, it doesn't feel... I'm not sure about
the
casting.
I do know what you mean, because I think in my mind's eye, there has always been a dark... brunette, slightly kind of wistful vibe going down. I've nicked
totally.
Your vibing word there. So the kind of sunshine Barbie is not quite there for me.
But maybe she's gonna pull it off. Like, I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah. Well, me too. I mean, let's all go and see it and come back and talk about it.
And talk smack about it.
Yes. We'll probably be absolutely speechless with its wonder.
I'm sure.
Next, you've also been reading This House of Grief by Helen Garner. Now, we are self-confessed Garner... files in the afternoon show, and I know that your boss, would you call him your boss? Your
hierarchical
superior.
Yeah.
Robbie Millen, was chair of the judges that chose her diaries for the Bailey Gifford. So
as he reminds me every day.
Yes, and I've just added to it. I'm so sorry, Susie. But we need to separate her talents, don't we? Because they're many and varied. And this House of Grief, fact or fiction? I confess I don't know.
It's factual. I think that's such a good point. She's such a Renaissance woman. She has so many strings to her bow. So I think her novels are amazing. But this is one of her kind of... very high-class true crime novels is how I'd describe it. But true crime is such an awful term because it sounds so sort of exploitative and down-market these days. I think it's really been tainted. But I think these are such moral books. And this House of Grief story, really upsetting story. Father estranged from his wife in Melbourne in the early 2000s, driving his three young sons back to deliver them to their mother, car swerves off the road. And the three young boys drown in a dam where the car lands, and the father swims to safety. So really upsetting story. He's put on trial, of course, for murder. But I think what's really interesting about Helen Garner is she doesn't, often with sort of like a tabloid approach to that story, would draw very strong moral lines, right? And would say, he's a monster and make us all feel safe. You know, he's a monster. He's killed his sons. We're nothing like that. And she says, well, and she sort of, you know, talks to her friends, talks about moments where they've maybe, you know, in moments of great stress or upset, like not protected their kids. There are kind of these seeds of sort of rottenness in all of us, and I think she really goes to those dark places, so it's amazing.
Yeah, okay, so that's a good recommendation. Finally, you want to redraw our reattention to Bleak House by Charles Dickens.
I'm very highbrow this week, aren't
you
I?
You are.
I'm
we're very impressed.
Very good about myself.
This
very
is impressed. Our highbrow item of the week, isn't it?
It is. It always is. And it's only Monday.
So feel no shame.
Thank you so much. I feel fantastic.
Good.
Yes, Bleak House. January is so miserable, so I think it's great to read a really miserable book. And like, it's so full of terrible weather, Bleak House. Everything's always muddy and freezing and snowy, which I think is sort of good to immerse yourself in. It's got that amazing opening with a kind of dinosaur climbing up Hoban Hill, and it's a soap opera, really. You know, it's murder, it's terrible illness, it's family feuding, it's lost wills. And so, you know, it's big, but it flies by. It's very funny, full of jokes, all those memorable minor characters. I think it's a real hoot.
Okay. So the thing that I always remember from the comedy, Bleak House, is actually the Jarndyce and Jarndyce theme, because the constant, our day of judgment will come, it will come, we will have justice, we will be okay. It's so cleverly observed through the desperation of the outcome of a legal case that never, ever comes to fruition. It's always somewhere there over the horizon, isn't it?
Totally. And, you know, I was focusing on the silly bits, but you're absolutely right. It has this really kind of sad, dark heart, this idea of these people who spend their whole lives waiting for a legal system that delivers the opposite of justice. And you kind of see that all around us still today, right? The kind of the messages of that are still so real. And, the kind of slowly sucked out hope. It's beautifully observed.
Yeah, it really is. And it says something about a criminal justice system that really hasn't changed to this day.
Totally.
What a pleasure to see you here in the studio. Thank you very much indeed for coming in. So we've been talking about Wuthering Heights. We were talking about This House of Grief by Helen Garner. And we were talking about Bleak House by Charles Dickens.
And Susie Irene is grateful. She says, I totally agree with that review of Wuthering Heights. It's so reassuring to hear someone say they didn't particularly enjoy it. I've never been able to understand why it's so popular.
I'm so glad.
Suzanne says, something will be pulled off, I'm sure. I mean, in acting. I wonder if both will make the story interesting. That's Margot and Jacob, because I think it's a boring story. And wasn't he the actor who was oddly charisma-free as Elvis? He was, wasn't he? That was a recent film, wasn't it, when Jacob Elordi played Elvis?
I didn't see that.
It was in who? In the film Priscilla, Jacob Elordi. That's right, sorry.
Sophia Coppola,
I'm very grateful to Rosie, who's been she's been all over the production this afternoon, actually.
I tell you what, it's a little bit like sitting in the pub next door to a couple of people having a chat, and you get every third word. No, I'm across it.
But the every third word you get is really worth it. And Deb says, Wuthering Heights will always be Merle Oberon and Laurence Olivier to me. Jacob Elordi has the right vibe and a great Yorkshire accent if the trailers are to be relied upon. It's based on the book, but I don't expect it to be a faithful representation. No, and there's been quite a lot of fuss about the speech marks around Wuthering Heights on the posters, which hints at a reimagining of the tale.
Could be a good
tale.
Thing. Could be a good thing.
Well, certainly if you're anything to go by, Susie. Susie thinks the book's rubbish. Oh, there we go.
I can't quite say that.
We're all Bronte shivering in that vicarage. Parsonage, whatever it was.
Should
have written a better book.
What can I say?
Or perhaps if they'd been warmer, they would have written a better book. Emily Wood, anyway.
Isn't that right?
Susie, thank you.
Maybe there'll be a sequel, Wuthering Heights, The Heat Pump.
I'd read that.
Thank you very much. You'll come back anytime. Good to have you on. Thank you,
Thank
Susie.
You so much. Thank you.
Now, it's just worth mentioning that you've got to stay with Times Radio this afternoon and throughout the evening, because after John Pienaar with Drive, Kate Borsay is in charge from 7 o'clock, and she'll be talking to Alan Dershowitz, the US lawyer who's represented Donald Trump and is himself mentioned in the Epstein files. That will be on at 8 o'clock, so make sure you hear that. Right, it's Jane Garvey and Fee Glover here on Times Radio, and I think we're going to discuss important money matters in the company of Adam Shaw. Come in, Adam.
Hello.
Hello. You are there.
Yes, I am there. I can confirm that, at least.
Do you know what? We're going to keep you waiting for a little bit longer. We just have to go to this first. Keep waiting. We're talking gold and silver prices in a mojo. It's 4:15.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture, and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
Summer is calling. Book early for your trip to Turkey and get the most out of your holiday. Visit goturkey.com now and discover unforgettable experiences. Plan your summer getaway to Turkey today.
Donations to British Heart Foundation fund scientific research that can help save lives. People like Joe, who's pitching his next big business plan. Maria, who's sending out her wedding invitations. And Jack, who's just being a teenager again. Because when you donate, you fund more than just science. You help save lives. British Heart Foundation funds research that aims to cure inherited heart muscle diseases. But our work is not done. Donate now at bhf.org.uk and keep us beating.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
We talk about all kinds of things on our podcast, the resurgence of the butter dish, bizarre Valentine's Day promotions, dry or damp January, and Jane's recent encounter with musical theatre. You can also hear all of our 3:30 interviews in full, including recently Maggie O'Farrell and Sally Wainwright, and also David Baddiel, who came in to talk to us about his documentary In Defence of Cats. He told us that he learnt his love of cats, that's the animals, not the musical, from his dad.
He had three loves in his life: cats, football, and shouting, "Who the effing hell is this now?" every time the phone rang. That was essentially who my dad was. But he really, his only soft side came out around Fomfa, who was our cat. That was his strange name for her, based on her purr. He thought she used to purr by going Fomfa, Fomfa. Okay. And so he used to hold her up a lot and say, "You're a fantastic beast, aren't you, Fomfa? What a great beast you are." And for my dad, that was a love sonnet. And I think me and my brothers learnt there that cats were the sight of affection and softness and homeliness, like a home. For me, a house is not a home without a cat.
That's David Baddiel. You can download that and many, 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 and I really do mean many, other episodes wherever it is that you like to get your podcasts from.
Now, you might have heard our rehearsal of the introduction to Adam Shaw that was broadcast inadvertently live a couple of moments ago. We can do it for real now. Gold and silver tumbled this morning as a reversal of a record-breaking rally gathered pace. But there are plenty of people who still made a huge amount of money from the staggeringly good performance before the recent drop. So Adam Shaw is our personal finance guru, here to explain what's been going on. Gold and silver have both dropped in recent days, but before that, gold in particular, Adam, was just going gangbusters.
Yeah, it's the most extraordinary thing of recent times. Just to set this in context, because often I think, especially in the markets, people talk about there's massive use of the word dramatic and plunging and everything, and all those sorts of words, and it's rarely justified. Here is an example where it is worth getting out the keys to the word cupboard and using those words to give you the sense of what has gone on here. In January last year, gold was trading at $2,700 a troy ounce, so around $2,700. At the start of trading in February, it was $4,700. So even with the recent big fall you mentioned, gold has risen something like 69% since January last year. That is such a huge figure. I keep going back to check the graph because I thought, mate, I must have got that wrong. So we're talking about a 70% rise in the space of a year. To set that in context, had you put your money in a bank, you'd have been lucky to get 4%. If you put it into the average UK stock market, which has done extraordinarily well, that's up 20%. So you've done three times better than anything else out there. It's most extraordinary.
And is it because the world is so turbulent that gold is still regarded as the ultimate safe haven?
Yes, in short, there's a few things going on here. Donald Trump has got a lot to do with it. I know he has this sort of well-known preference for painting everything gold. He's also been useful for the gold market because of the risks associated with his US foreign policy and fiscal policies, wars in Ukraine, Gaza, the US seizure of the Venezuelan president, its threat to invade basically a NATO member, Greenland. And on the back of that as well, central banks have been buying gold. And so there's this FOMO, fear of missing out. It's been a big driver, even if investors weren't convinced of the justification of the recent gold price rise. They just felt they couldn't sit on their hands and do nothing and just watch this extraordinary pattern development. So even if they were nervous, lots of them joined in this gold rush. And of course, by joining in the gold rush, that itself pushes prices even higher.
And gold, I mean, this is the most basic question of all. Gold is expensive, is valuable, because it's incredibly rare, correct?
Yes, that is rare. I don't think it rusts either, so there's some sort of useful things going on here. In fact, the often quoted statistic here is that if you put all the gold ever mined throughout human history, it would barely be enough to fill 3.5 swimming pools, Olympic-sized swimming pools.
Okay.
So that is a measure of its rareness. Now, there are other rare things out there, but what helps gold is partly that we've always bought gold. You can turn it into jewellery, and lots of cultures actually see jewellery as a big gold investment as well as it looking nice. And it's relatively easy to get out of the ground compared to some other rare things.
Where is it mined? Where are the gold mines?
Well, goodness, all over the place. I mean, many in Africa. And in fact, I mean, there is actually some in Wales as well. I don't know if the gold mines in Wales are still active there.
Oh, yes. I think they don't they make the royal family's engagement rings?
Yes, I think that's what was in my mind there. Yeah. So I think that is happening as well. But that actually links to another question, because how do you invest in gold? You know, you can buy gold bars, but that's a bit difficult. Not impossible, but what on earth are you going to do with a gold bar? But a lot of investors are getting exposure to this market by buying shares in the mines you talk about. And there tends to be a bit of a delay in the price of the shares in miners. But of course, if gold is going up, then the companies that dig it out the ground and sell it, they should be more profitable. So that's one way people have been buying into this rally.
I'm still flabbergasted by that volume of gold. So three Olympic-sized swimming pools.
Well, that's the thing that is often quoted. I've never seen sort of academic research into it, but that is very widely quoted as a sort of good measure of just how little gold there is. But you get an awful lot of gold into three Olympic-sized swimming pools, to be honest. But it's not like coal or anything. That's the whole point of this thing. It is rare. It is portable. You can measure its sort of purity. The problem for gold is that it just sits there, not doing very much. It doesn't earn dividends. It doesn't pay interest. You've got to put it somewhere. It's probably quite dangerous to keep it in the house. You don't want to tell people that. So there's lots of problems with gold investments. And that's the reason for many, many years it hasn't performed well at all.
Okay. Tax advantages, are there any?
Yeah. You've got to be careful about this if you're trying to play gold for its tax advantages. But there do seem to be some. And that's because some gold is made into coins which are legal tender. So Royal Mint gold coins, some of them may be exempt from capital gains tax. And that particularly applies to gold sovereigns and gold Britannias. So if you are doing it for that reason, you know, you should check with the Royal Mint and others that the things you are buying are tax-free or free from capital gains tax. And also the problem with buying those coins, and they look really nice. You just go to the Royal Mint website and you can see what's on sale there. They're quite expensive, but they sell at a premium to the gold bar because there's some work involved in actually creating those coins, and they're works of art as well. So they sell at a premium, and that's harder to actually check the changing price than just gold bars, which you can go onto loads of websites and check the price straight away. So it's harder with gold coins, but that's certainly something to look at.
Now, the eagle-eared amongst you, the minion doesn't speak normally and does sit with us while we're doing the programme, but isn't allowed to speak. I don't know who gave them permission to speak this afternoon.
I'm really sorry.
No, I bet you are.
I left my phone on accidentally and it rang. I'm sorry, everybody.
Right.
It's very unprofessional.
Well, Adam carried on like a galleon in full sail.
Yeah. Well done you. Yeah, well done.
Thank you.
Do you have a... I'm going to end with this question, Adam. Do you have a gold nugget to tell us?
I have, yes, a metaphorical gold nugget. I think one of the bizarre things... I do bizarre things. One is that London's built on clay and they get worried at the Bank of England that the gold will actually cause problems with the foundation. So there are strict limits on how high they can stack their gold, and the people who move it around in the Bank of England have to be relatively fit. The other really bizarre thing, I think, is that when you move billions of dollars around the world at a click of a button... Mad, it sounds medieval. When they move gold bars from London to New York, the standard gold bar in London is 400 ounces, yeah, about 12 and a half kilos. In New York, it's a kilo. So what they have to do is they send the gold bars to Switzerland, melt them down, reset them in a different bar, and then put them on a plane to New York. Bizarre.
I'm really new to all this, but I would have thought they'd be standard, that it'd be a global standard. There isn't.
You and I should run the financial system, Jane. I think that would be a very sensible thing to do, but it's not how it's done.
Wow, I'm astounded. I know you've written about this, A Guide to Gold, at themoneydoctor.tv, and your socials are at Adam Shaw Biz. The fact that it has plunged in price over the last couple of days, is that what does that tell us about the global situation, that things are getting marginally calmer? I mean, it doesn't seem that way.
Well, I think that was in particular for two reasons. One is that the announcement from President Trump of a new chair Fed, of the US Central Bank, which was seen to be a bit more mainstream than many had feared. But also, people are just worried about how high this price has gone. So everyone was watching everyone else. And just as there was a fear of missing out on the rise, there's a fear of missing out on the exit door. So the moment some people started leaving, everyone else looked at them and went, maybe I should check, cash in my profits now. And that's why we've seen this sell-off. It has a long way to fall if that really takes hold, that rush for the exit. But at the moment, it's still done amazing stuff over the past 12 months.
Adam, lovely to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. It's themoneydoctor.tv or at Adam Shaw Biz.
Now, Tansy lives in hope. For my silver wedding anniversary, my husband bought me a silver coin. It's beautiful. I'm hoping to make it to 50 years of marriage and get a gold coin. Well, now would be the week to buy it, Tansy. If there's anything that we can do to help things along, you just sit your husband down, make sure he's listening to the afternoon show, send him a coded message via us. Yeah. That's it from us today. We'll be back tomorrow from 2. You can hear even more of us, if you want to, on our daily podcast, Off Air with Jane and Fee. Tomorrow, our guest is Emma B. She'll be making the very long walk down from the 17th floor of this building, I think. Our producer today was Rosie Cutler. Our technical operator was Adam Heaton. Up next, it's John Pienaar with Drive. Have a very good evening when you get to it.
Yes, goodbye.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Fee. Thank you, Jane. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar, and this is Times Radio Drive. Here are the headlines. Sir Keir Starmer believes Lord Mandelson should no longer be a member of the House of Lords or use his title over his links to the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. And the serial killer Steve Wright has pleaded guilty to kidnapping and murdering a 17-year-old girl more than 25 years ago in Suffolk. And coming up, we'll bring you the latest news, the breaking news, the best analysis of the story of Peter Mandelson. We'll have reaction from politicians, from the former Director of Public Prosecution, Sir David Calvert-Smith, and much more besides.
This is Times Radio.
And here's the news with Stuart Winnie.
John, thank you. Good afternoon. Sir Keir Starmer thinks Lord Mandelson should do the right thing and hand back his peerage. A Downing Street spokesman says the Prime Minister also thinks the former US ambassador should give evidence to Congress about his friendship with Jeffrey Epstein. Meanwhile, there are calls for the Crown Prosecution Service to consider whether there's a criminal case against Peter Mandelson over the leaking of government secrets. Documents suggest in 2009 the then business secretary shared highly sensitive market-moving information on plans to sell off public assets. The tax lawyer and investigative journalist Dan Needle told Times Radio that may have benefited Epstein's clients.
It was at almost exactly the same time around this period that Epstein was making the donations, gifts, call them what you will, to Lord Mandelson's partner. Surely Epstein knew there was a link between him making the payments to Mandelson and Mandelson leaking to him. And of course, then it was only 3 months after the email was leaked that Lord Mandelson was lobbying against his own government.
Downing Street say they're urgently reviewing the correspondence. Lord Mandelson says he doesn't recognise the claims. Independent MP Dan Norris has vigorously and entirely denied allegations of rape, sexual assault, voyeurism and upskirting after he was further arrested by police. The 65-year-old was suspended by the Labour Party and had the whip in the Commons removed last year. He remains on conditional bail. A serial killer known as the Suffolk Strangler has pleaded guilty to a sixth murder. Steve Wright, who was convicted in 2008 of killing five women in Ipswich, now admits murdering 17-year-old Victoria Hall in 1999. He's also admitted kidnapping a 22-year-old woman the night before. The Labour MP Tulip Siddiq has been sentenced to 4 more years in prison on corruption charges. It's over land deals in Bangladesh linked to Siddiq's aunt, the country's deposed Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina. Labour says it can't recognise the judgment of the Bangladeshi court. A Russian ship's captain has been found guilty of manslaughter after a crash with an oil tanker off the Yorkshire coast. Vladimir Motin was found to have caused the death of Filipino crewman Mark Angelo Pernia when the Solong struck the Stena Immaculate, which was anchored, causing a massive explosion. Detective Chief Superintendent Craig Nicholson is from Humberside Police.
The fact that we only have one very, very tragic death, I think that is in itself an absolute miracle, because this was a significant explosion. The Solong burned for 8 days following the collision. I think it was only the quick thinking of the American captain and crew that got them all to a place of safety and evacuated quite quickly. I think that saved a lot of lives.
And less than 1,000 migrants arrived in the UK on small boats last month, the lowest January figure for 5 years. Home Office data shows 933 people made the crossing, a 15% drop on the same time last year. People in life jackets have been seen arriving in Ramsgate today, the first arrivals in almost 2 weeks. For a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. John Pienaar at Drive. On Times Radio.
I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. Well, if you thought Peter Mandelson being a close friend of a convicted billionaire paedophile was shocking, what do you call him casually passing Jeffrey Epstein highly market-sensitive information? You can call it what you like. Some at Westminster are calling for the police to be called in. This scandal just got so much worse. Now, the damning emails keep coming as I speak. But just try this. Peter Mandelson tipped off Epstein in advance about a multi-billion euro bailout for Greece at the height of that country's public debt crisis. Sensitive information does not get much more sensitive or potentially useful to a market trader. We already knew about advice to the then Prime Minister Gordon Brown circulating deep inside Downing Street about public asset sales, which he sent to Epstein too. But if Mandelson, as he is now, Lord Mandelson, leaked secret info that could make money for an Epstein client or crony, would that amount to a misconduct in public life, a crime which is punishable by prison? Let's talk about that. Now, earlier, Keir Starmer's office suggested Lord Mandelson should follow the former Prince Andrew in being stripped of his ermine and coronet, demoted to a common mister, and a disgraced mister at that. Will that happen? We'll also be looking at the likelihood of Mandelson being called to appear before a congressional committee in Washington. If that happens, he'd be interrogated live on air before an audience of millions. His own ordeal, his public humiliation, would reflect on everyone who has stood by him and on the judgment of the Prime Minister who defended and appointed him to the embassy in Washington. What are the chances of that happening? We'll talk about that too. I wonder what you are thinking about this developing scandal. Send me a text, 87222, start with the word Times, or a tweet to @timesradio. Now let's just backtrack and see how we got here. On Times Radio Breakfast, the tax expert Dan Needle said Peter Mandelson shared government documents with Jeffrey Epstein that would have benefited his clients while he was business secretary. He told Kate McCann and Stig Abel the Crown Prosecution Service should consider whether there's a criminal case against him.
Obviously, Epstein's crimes are appalling, but if this was some completely innocuous financial figure in New York, it would still be deeply corrupt for a senior British politician to receive money from him, to forward emails to him, to lobby the British government for him, and to give him tips that his client should mildly threaten the British government.
Tax expert there, Dan Needle. Now, the Tory party leader, Kemi Badenoch, called for a full cabinet office investigation.
If there is evidence of potential criminal activity, then of course, yes, we need to have due process. But that should not be an excuse for the Prime Minister to say it's got nothing to do with him. It does. He appointed this man despite several warnings, multiple people raising red flags. He ignored those. He did not carry out a proper vetting. We need to get all of the papers in the files to explain how this happened in the first place.
It's the Conservative Party leader, Kemi Badenoch. Now, let's check in, first of all, with Aubrey Allegretti, the Times' chief political correspondent. Aubrey, welcome to the programme.
Thank you, John.
Do share your thoughts then, Aubrey. Peter Mandelson's friendship with Epstein, of course, cost him his job as ambassador. These latest leaks, they are far more explosive, aren't they? They have prompted questions about potential misconduct in public life, which is a crime. This could hardly be more serious.
That's certainly the case. And I mean, there is an avalanche of allegations coming out now. There are, I think, 5,938 mentions of Mandelson in the Epstein files that were released by the Department of Justice in the US last Friday, which is why it's taken some time for journalists to be able to comb through them. But we now obviously learn about email exchanges suggesting a tip-off about this 500 billion euro bailout during the financial crisis that faced Greece. We've also heard about Peter Mandelson forwarding an email on from a senior aide to the Prime Minister, which suggested this sell-off of £20 billion worth of public assets, which would, of course, be of incredibly lucrative knowledge to somebody who was a financier and made their money from brokering deals and being very knowledgeable about what was coming up in the city circuit. So Peter Mandelson, this whole sort of thread started with his